Welcome, everyone, to the A Better Way to A podcast. We are your hosts, Jordan and Andrew, and today we're here with Warren Stoddard II. Warren's been in Syria. He's been in Ukraine. He also, my personal favorite, rides choppers and builds choppers and regular motorcycles. Thank you for coming onto the show, Warren.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm super pumped to talk to you about your triple life that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
You got a lot going on.
Oh, yeah, all the time.
So you most recently, it looks like you got back from Ukraine not too long ago in the grand scheme of things. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was latter part of 2022.
Okay, you just don't post a lot.
Oh, yeah, I don't post too much. Yeah.
That makes sense.
I don't know. I was on the internet pretty heavy, and then just like every time I opened up my phone, something bad happened. So I had to take a break from that.
I don't blame you, man. I don't blame you. Well, motorcycles are a good way to do that.
That's true. Yeah. After I got back from Ukraine, was down in Birmingham, Alabama, got a job working with my buddy Dwayne at the Peculiar Parts House. We did vintage motorcycles there. We were building stock bikes, all old Harleys. Built a few show bikes, a couple old panhead choppers and shovel heads. We had a lot of fun doing that. That was probably one of the better jobs I've ever had in my life.
That's the bike you guys had at the Mama Tried show, right?
Yeah. We put a 59 panhead in Mama Tried last year. Took that bike all over the country. Won a few shows with it. That was like 400 hours of polishing. Probably not 400, but a lot of hours of polishing. Yeah. We put it together in the span of 4 weeks. So I guess there ain't even 400 hours right there. But
yeah.
It was a lot of polishing.
Was that your first time when you got that job? Was that your first time working on motorcycles, or was that like returning to an old passion?
That was kind of returning to it. So I inherited my dad's old shovel head, the 68 shovel, that after he passed away, it was kind of just stored in this Bluebird school bus that we had out behind our house in Texas. And when I was, I think, 20 or 19, pulled it out of the bus and I started putting it back together, and pretty quick figured out I didn't know what the fuck I was doing.
Yeah.
So then I had actually made friends with a bunch of my dad's old friends, and they kind of showed me the ropes and was riding it around and blew up the motor. One of my dad's buddies, showed me how to go through a motor and build it step by step by step. Did all of that. As soon as I did that, blew up the transmission, same thing. Old motorcycle is one of those things where if you have one long enough, you kind of got to either be really rich or learn to work on it yourself. So I was the latter. Yeah, so that was a return, I guess. I mean, I kind of dabbled here and there, but that was my first time, with a full-time job that was working on motorcycles.
That's awesome, okay, man. That's, okay. So you kind of started working on them and then got to live out every young gearhead's dream by actually building a bike with a shop.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a nice business card if your bike starts first kick every time and you ride it around the country and people start to figure out you know what you're doing, and then eventually they ask you to do it for money.
Yeah, that's a win. I've got like a cheater bike, man, because I have an Evo and chopped it out. It's got a kick on it, but it also has a button in case for those times where it doesn't start.
Yeah.
And I'll do like a quick look around. It was my first go at building a bike, and I built it with like a ton of help of a friend of mine who's been building bikes up in Connecticut for longer than I've been alive. I was like, you know, I would love to have a kick only bike, but I want to ride this thing to like work and back. I want to ride it around as much as I can. So like, maybe if we could just hide a little starter button in somewhere in the frame, that would be great. And he did. And it has gotten me out of a pickle a ton of times.
Yeah. You got the kicker whenever you need to look cool. And then,
it's 100% when I want to look cool. Like if I look around and there's like, I can't even say before I was married because I didn't have this bike before I was married.
It's okay to want to impress the ladies. Even
yeah,
if, married,
you know, this is a
it's just
couple
nice,
bros on Dinas thinking they look so cool. And then I go and pull up and first kick my bike over. And the worst thing is when it's like it's a relatively new bike. It's a 93 compared to like a, you know, a panhead.
Yeah.
And when it doesn't start first kick, I look really bad.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than getting outside the bar. Maybe you had a couple, two, three, too many.
No, never.
Cold snacks. When he's trying to kick the bike, and it's like I've taken my electric start off, and it's like it's the worst thing in the world. Whenever it won't start, you just spend 10 minutes walking around a thing,
sweating.
Like
sweating.
Yeah, sweating in winter.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh no. Yeah, I drive a Subaru, so these are problems I can't relate
to. Subarus ain't nothing to laugh at. I fucking love Subarus.
Dude, I have a Subaru also. We're part of the Subi gang on this podcast. I will say, though, what?
Subaru's definitely what Toyota used to be.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, like Subarus just do it all. They look nice. They're comfortable. They last forever. Used to work for this car review website and had to write, like, how long will they last articles. And the Toyota, like, their bell curve of how long they last in the production years is going down and down, and Subaru's going up and up. So
that's what I want to hear, because I do not plan on buying another car anytime soon. So that's a win.
Yeah, I think they last a lifetime. What's their slogan? It's like 90% of Subarus are still on the road after 20 years.
Yeah, they don't tell you how many pieces, though.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's a bit of a ship of Theseus problem too, right? Where it's like mine's only a 2011, and I've already replaced, like, I've had to replace, I think, almost every part of the steering and front suspension.
Damn.
And all of the rubber in the car, and any rubber gasket, hose, anything in the from front to back has been replaced. At least
sounds
once.
Like you're driving on bumpy roads.
I mean, I don't know. I live in the city.
Yeah, I don't know.
You know, there's potholes.
Yeah.
Speaking of Subarus.
Yeah, maybe I just take turns too aggressively.
Yeah, maybe. I want to know how you, kind of like what came first, the chicken or the egg here. So you started with motorcycles when you inherited your dad's bike. At what point did you decide to go to Syria?
Well, I guess I've had that bike since I was 3, so I think it came first, but the two, I don't know, they sort of go hand in hand. My dad was murdered when I was 3, so...
Jesus.
It's like it wasn't my first memory of him getting killed, but it was, like, probably my first 10 memories. So, like, I had vivid recollections of his... Like, I spent more time with his headstone than him, right? And on his headstone,
man,
he was a recon Marine. And so all my life, it just said Steve Stoddard, U.S. Marine Corps, and then had his recon insignia below it. And I always looked at that, and I was like, I want to be a recon Marine. And so when I was 18, I enlisted on my 18th birthday. I was all set to go, and then 2012, Obama downsized the military. And then the first ones, the easiest ones to kick out were the ones who needed waivers. So they told me that my waivers were no longer going to work out because I had a knee surgery that the doctor fucked up. So that didn't work. Sorry, I'm getting over that illness. But yeah.
All good.
So then I went to college, and then, I didn't go to college straight away after high school. I worked construction for a year. One of my buddies told me, hey, come do Army ROTC. So I did that, just trying to get some kind of military life or experience going. That one didn't work out because my hearing is also fucked. I kind of won the genetic lottery as far as my joints and my ears go.
Yeah.
But then probably around 2016, which I think is when I got the bike running too, a guy named Levi Shirley was killed in the YPG. And he was from Colorado. And I was like, well, what the fuck is the YPG? And then I kind of read about Levi Shirley, and he had a similar thing where he tried to join the Marine Corps, and then something happened medically to where it didn't work out, and he went to Syria. And so then I decided, well, shit, that sounds interesting. And then I was like on YouTube or something one day and saw a PBS documentary, and I was like, fuck, I want to do that. So I was about to graduate. And then about the same time, Turkey invaded Afrin. And once Turkey invaded Afrin, I was set, fully determined to do it, and then started the process.
Damn. That is that's some motivation, man.
Hey, yeah. So you weren't like ideologically pulled at first, at least. It first you were like, I want to serve in a good cause. I want to fight for something. But did you end up sort of like ideologically aligning with these people once you were over there fighting with them?
Yeah, that's kind of exactly what happened. So I initially started communicating with the YPG recruitment, and basically like, hey, I have a little bit of military background. I'm a certified firefighter. Like, I have some skills. And then they like make you read some literature on like the cause and everything and the women's revolution. And it's like the whole liberation movement of the Kurdish struggle. And then as I read these, I think it was four books I had to read, it was like everything that they were writing, from like ecology to the women's rights to democratic and federalism, all of it was kind of lining up with thoughts that I had had all along, but I didn't know that necessarily there was a name to put on that kind of political thought.
Yeah.
So like in the process of joining the YPG, I realized that I also, on top of wanting to fight against ISIS and like fight for Kurdish liberation, I also identified with their political policies.
They call it like democratic confederalism, right?
Yeah, democratic confederalism. It's like states exist without borders. Like our idea of the nation state is kind of contrived, and there's no real reason why a nation should exist, for lack of a better term. So like people can, like, borders don't really make sense. I mean, to put it in like an American perspective, like there's not much difference from a Latino in like northern Mexico and the southwestern U.S. Like all of that used to be
for sure
what is, like, what has become two different nations but at one time was one. And then Kurdistan is very similar. It's like a colonial, regions were formed and borders got drawn by kind of outside powers, and so the Kurdish state has never been recognized.
And you know, you and I, you grew up in Texas, right?
Yeah, I grew up in a little town called Gypsum Springs. It's about 15
miles. Yeah, I know where it is.
Austin. Okay.
Yeah, I live in San Antonio. I grew up here too. And so for this part of the world, especially like, you know, the San Antonio, Houston, Dallas kind of triangle, but, you know, also like further on south, that idea kind of rings true for a lot of people, I think, whether they realize it or not, that like, you know, you could be part of a diaspora that kind of like spans, you know, two or three different countries.
Right. Yeah. So these borders have basically been put down that divide people, like from one side of the line to another, even though the people on either side of the line are more or less the same. And that has lots of far reaching effects on like people's identity, people's belonging in the world. And so I think like the American Southwest in some small way is similar to what we've seen in the Middle East after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that the idea would be a lot more popular if it wasn't for all this culture war brain rot.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a lot of culture war brain rot going on. The nice buzzword of communism every time.
Communism is what I don't like or don't understand.
Yeah. Well, and I talk about open borders and people are like, I'm either called a communist or a fascist libertarian, you know?
Right. Well, my thing is everybody complains about illegal immigration. I'm like, well, fuck, if it wasn't so hard to legally immigrate, then they wouldn't have to be doing this. Yeah,
it is. Hell it is a it's a pretty circular argument that we get from a lot of people that oppose that kind of stuff. So how long were you in Syria for?
I was in Syria from June of 2018 till about February of 2019.
Did you go in planning to spend that much time there, or did it just kind of happen?
I went in planning to spend, like, I wanted to go until the war ended against ISIS. Then I wound up getting wounded. And after that, I was like, am I really going to be effective here? And then I had gotten told some things by the medical staff, like I was going to need surgery, even though I got back to the U.S. and like, oh, we don't do surgeries on, like, bullets left over in you. I was like, well, shit.
Yeah, you had to come back to the U.S. with it still in your leg, right?
Yeah, I've still got a little piece of Dushka round in my foot.
Yeah. Yeah, damn. they don't take foreign objects like that out.
That's like tissue.
Why is that?
It's like more dangerous to take it out than just
it'll cause more trauma to your body to pull it out rather than just leaving it in there.
That's wild to me. I guess, yeah, because it would leave like a vacuum, like a hole.
Yeah, and then you gotta get the surgery done and you gotta recover. Like, you've already recovered from the gunshot. Like, do you want to recover from a surgery as well?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's like adding insult to injury there.
Yeah.
That blows. Yeah, so did you set off the metal detector when you came back into the country?
Whenever I was going through the Doha airport, I was setting off the explosives detectors.
Wow.
And they, like, thought that I had a bomb with me or something like that.
You're like keistering C4?
I guess. They only stopped me a few times, and they, like, would search my bag, and they were, like, showing me the scanner. It's like explosives. I'm like, I don't have no explosives on me. Which they finally believed, which was nice.
Yeah, that is nice. It looks like Andrew's having issues with his camera or something like that.
Yeah.
That's wild. I can't imagine going through a security system multiple times like that and having that kind of experience and just knowing it's going to happen. I don't know if you knew it was going to happen every time, but
I didn't know it was going to happen until it did there. Cause, on our way out of Iraqi Kurdistan, we just kind of got waved through, didn't even have to scan our bags or anything. So that was my first little glimpse back into the real world. And it was just explosives.
That's nuts. So you got back from Syria, and did you make the decision to stay over here for a while, or did you just like were you okay with not going back? Was it because you were wounded, or did you decide to take some time off of here? I mean, you did a year. Definitely, you definitely did time over there for sure.
Yeah. I mean, that year was so formative for me that even now it's been 5 years and I'm still wondering how to recover from it.
Yeah.
Like, so many things happened in that little aged gap between 23 and 24 for me that, I don't know. It was hard to move past. I got there and that was my first time just being in a unit like that, and the camaraderie that you build and the friendships that you make are so much bigger than anything that you can really find anywhere else. There's so much stakes to it. And then being in combat, was hard to move on. So I initially, I tried to go back almost right away and then didn't wind up working out, but yeah.
Yeah, I can't imagine, man. That's, I feel like we've got a very, from my own personal experience, and I think I speak for people in general in the West, like, we've got a very nationalistic view of military service or fighting in wars, because the only thing that we're ever exposed to, I was in the Marines for 6 years. I never went anywhere, but I was in the reserves, and when I got out, was always kind of bummed that I never did anything. And when I started hearing about the stuff in Syria, a light bulb went off. I obviously didn't do anything. I was still here, and I did not make that sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
But and I think a lot of people don't think that Americans going over there, it's maybe because it's not covered as much as Western war stuff is on the news, there's so many people. Like, there are American or English speaking units over there just comprised of people speaking English, and the people over here have no idea. Meanwhile, you've got guys that are coming back with the same scars that they would have gotten from a war in the Middle East, but with less recognition, no benefits, no like support structure that you would have gotten if you like if it was on with the US military.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, say what you want about the VA and US military stuff, but at least it's something. And
well, it's nice to have something. I mean, yeah, it was interesting because, like, at the time, like, before Ukraine kicked off, Syria was, like, the most reported on and most, like, covered war in the history of all wars. Really, like, you could follow it live time on the map. And
that's wild because I never heard of it. Like, until we started having, until ISIS was like a big thing, or I don't know, maybe it was, it's been going on for a long time, but I had only heard about it until maybe the last few years. The fact that there were people still fighting over there. And I think it says a lot about the stuff that we're exposed to here.
Yeah. You know, I think there's a tendency for Americans to just want to jump onto the next thing and like say, oh, this has been going on for way too long, and to stop caring about it. But like,
yeah,
you lose sight of the fact that like there was a fucking 100 years war in the 1300s between France and Great Britain.
Yeah.
Vietnam lasted 20 years of US involvement and like 30 years of foreign involvement. So we just have a much shorter attention span as society. I think that's a global thing as well. But yeah, not having a support system is weird. And like to this day, I still don't know, like, were there 300 international volunteers in the YPG or were there 3,000? And,
really?
I mean, yeah. So many people like were esoteric about it. Didn't want anybody to know they were there. Didn't want anybody to know they came back. And, I don't fault them for doing that. I obviously wasn't one of those people. But I think that had a lot to do with no one really knowing that people were doing this unless somebody got killed, like Levi Shirley.
Yeah.
Well, and some people face like legal problems going back to their home countries. I know of at least one guy from like Sweden that his like family was investigated for involvement in like terrorism.
Yeah.
He fought for the white.
Yeah, so like Australia, for example, like you're facing a lot of jail time if you go to any foreign conflict.
That's
two
wild.
Of my good friends, Sam Newey and Dan Burke. Sam Newey, he was in the UK, and this might be the one you're thinking about. His father sent his brother, Dan Newey, like $100. And so then they tried to charge the whole family with funding terrorism.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, yeah. It's
yeah.
Like Dan UK 90-something.
Yeah, yeah, that's Dan.
Yeah. What the fuck?
Well, that was his family that dealt with that. And then Daniel Burke, after he got back to the UK, went to prison on terrorism charges for a year before they finally dropped his case, I guess. And he was in the same jail cells with ISIS members. So there are some...
How do you get terrorism charges to stick when you're literally fighting ISIS?
That's something...
Well, they don't
care.
Yeah,
they that's don't... something I've never been able to make sense
because
of.
Because you're fighting with brown people, and that, they don't like that.
Yeah,
you're just not doing what you're supposed to do.
They think that everybody's bad.
That's crazy. Well, I mean, we know that based on, you know, the Americans' reaction to drone striking Syrian neighborhoods.
Yeah.
God.
I mean, I'll never forget this. I was at a bar. I was hanging out with my friend John. And we were sitting there drinking, and it was the day after the U.S. had launched those missile strikes. It's like the 66 missile strikes in 2018. And this fucking drunk dude comes up to me at this little outdoor table and sits down, straddling the bench and facing me. And he's like, so what do you guys think about Syria? And I was like, is this a fucking psyop right now?
are you a fucking vet?
And then John's across the table and he goes, dude, you're barking up the wrong tree. And he's like, no, I want to know what you guys think about Syria, all those missile strikes. And I was like, all right. If you want to talk about Syria, tell me what you think about Afrin. And it was just like blank face, had no idea what I was talking about. And you get like the selective news dropped to you by like every end of the media So you don't really get a full picture of what's going on unless you devote yourself.
I'll even say, like, I don't even think you have to devote yourself to know what's going on. I think you just have to do a little bit more than what is expected.
Yeah.
And I know someone like you who has like tons of experience, you're intimately familiar, but we all have access to Google. Like, it's not beyond anyone's expertise.
Taken me very much effort to keep up with just the broad strokes of these conflicts.
People just choose not to. And I do think that it's one of those things, like you said, people lose interest quickly, and it's sad. It really is. Like, it's one of those things. It's like, well, this is halfway across the world. It doesn't affect me yet. So how much time do I really have to invest in it? You know, people spend more time looking up what stocks their favorite celebrities are investing in to follow them and try to make money off of it than they do international conflicts.
Right. And what you said about, like, all you have to do is Google it. It's like people all the time will be like, how do I join the YPG?
And I'm
like, oh. Fucking Google it. How do you think I figured out how to join the YPG?
Yeah.
It's like that meme where the person dies and like death comes down on a cloud. It's like you just had a guy come down, airdrop out of the sky and say, do you want to join the YPG? It wasn't quite like that. You had to put in some effort.
And that's a nice filter too, isn't it? Like to get the kind of people that you want fighting in that conflict, I think that the very first requirement should be you have to Google it yourself.
Yeah. I mean, you got to think about, like, the vetting for the U.S. military is one thing, but then think about the vetting that you want to do on a guy who will voluntarily, with his own money, buy a one-way ticket to Iraq to be smuggled into Syria. Like, you're already going to get some fucking nut jobs. So you want the right kind of nut job.
Yeah. Not, you know, it's like, who does that? 3D printing, like whenever you see people advertise 3D printing files for guns, you'll always have someone in the comments who will be like, can you show me how to do this? And every time the response is, learn how to fucking do it yourself. Like it's twofold. It's like, hey, get off your ass and do something yourself. And it's also like an infosec thing. Like we can't show you how to print a gun, because it's illegal. If you learn how to do it yourself, that's something completely different.
Yeah, like make you printing the gun is not illegal, but me doing it for you.
Yeah, but exactly. You also just don't want idiots like having 3D printed guns, whereas I'm sure you don't want idiots fighting with the YPJ. Like it's
idiots have gun rights too, bud.
I know they do. I know.
Yeah, I mean there were some idiots that slipped through the cracks, but for the most part, by the time I got there, at least everybody was more or less ideologically minded, and they all had their heads on straight. We did have one guy who went kind of nuts, and we had to kick him out. We had a few guys who went kind of nuts, we had to kick him out, but one was worse than the others. He, like, threatened to take my rifle and kill all of us, do some weird shit.
Oh.
So there were some...
How do you kick someone like that out? Like, how do you... They're not even supposed to be there. They're already going to be, like, violently psychotic. Like, how do you kick somebody out?
So in the YPG, it's like... It's probably a lot more organized than most people would imagine. Like, there's a whole series of things that have to happen. So in this process called tech mill, you're able to criticize somebody. And this happens every day. Like, you criticize somebody if they made a mistake, or if they weren't taking into consideration how their actions might affect someone, and you just, like, you criticize them for it. And so you start out with criticizing them, and then if this problem persists, then you get to take it to the next level where you basically hand that tech mail information to the commander, and then the commander steps in, tries to mediate it. After that, if it still doesn't get figured out, then it goes to what's called a platform. And the platform, more or less, is a trial. And everybody in the unit is the jury.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that has to happen. And then, like, from that, you figure out, like, do you want this person in this unit? If the answer is no, then there's a series of steps you can take to either get them in another unit, if that's possible, or basically force them out of the country. Because, like, the YPG is the one to controlling who's moving in and out of the country anyway, so they can get them back over. And then if you're on bad enough terms, they will basically stick you on the other side of the Iraqi border, and then you getting home is on your own.
Good luck.
Yeah.
Sounds like that is not the relationship that you want to foster while you're there.
No, that would be a pretty bad move.
excuse me, should have muted for that. So you've written a few books, and I know you've written one about motorcycles, but you also wrote one about your experience in Syria, right?
Yeah, so my first book was a novella. It's called No Birds in Yesterday. That's like Louis L'Amour on choppers, about basically retelling the story of Don Quixote. And then the one about
But on
Syria
choppers?
on choppers, yeah. Louis L'Amour on
That's
choppers.
sick.
The one about Syria is called A Good Place on the Banks of the Euphrates. And that one's a collection of short stories. Some of them are fiction, some of them are nonfiction, and then a lot of my journal entries that I kept. For like, for some reason, the only time I keep a journal is whenever I'm at war. I guess I'm so bored. And so I kind of mixed those in with the short stories and short memoir pieces that I had written and published after I got back.
Where did that come from? Where did you decide, like, when did you decide that you were going to write about this and publish your journal entries and whatnot?
That was 2021. That was after I published my first book, and I the first book had done so well that I very stupidly quit my job, and I was like, you know, I've already got all this material. I might as well compile it into a second book.
That's cool. That's
Have
cool,
you been
man.
able to support yourself that way?
I supported myself on my writing for about 2 years with no other job. And then the past couple of years, I've had to start doing real work again,
You
which, I
should.
mean, living like solely on your book earnings is pretty hard unless you're like the number one New York Times bestseller.
Yeah.
So the fact that I got to do that for almost 2 years, like, I'm super grateful for that. Not a lot of
Yeah.
writers ever get to do that.
Did you do a lot of riding during those 2 years?
A lot of writing. Like motorcycle
Motorcycles.
riding, or
Riding, not
sorry,
riding.
riding.
Not riding, but riding.
Riding. Yeah, I know that was probably should have used a better, more
With a
descriptive
D.
word.
Riding with a D.
Yeah, riding
Yeah.
with a D. Sorry, I'm from
Yeah,
Connecticut.
that's.
We don't do our we don't say our D's
Yeah.
or T's, our T's.
Yeah, those 2 years I've rode all over the place. I rode to Mexico. So I was living in Alabama at the time. I rode to Mexico, rode to California. I went up around the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, went up the East Coast, went down into Florida. I mean, I've hit three of the four corners of this country. Yeah, I rode that bike a lot during those 2 years, and that was amazing.
Was that the was that Electric Glide you were riding?
Yeah, that was my dad's bike.
That's sick.
It's been my one and only, I guess. I mean, it's like it's pink and green. Which he painted to match his Oakley sunglasses. And so I just inherited that. And then whenever I first got it, I was like, I'm going to sand this paint off. This is stupid and gay because I was 18 and an idiot. I started sanding it and I was like, fuck, this is so much harder than I thought it was going to be. I'm stopping. And then I woke up the next morning and I was like, what the fuck have I done? Yeah, so I'm glad I didn't have the patience for that. But yeah, that's my dad's bike. That's the only one I think I'll never get rid of.
That's awesome, man. I always envied, I mean, not in your case with how you got your bike, unfortunately, but I've always envied people that have gotten cool, like, motorized things from their parents. My dad was a jeweler, so, like, and he was never good with his hands, never worked on his own cars. He would always just, like, throw money at stuff in order to fix it.
Yeah.
And, so, like, I could tell you the different types of clarity on a diamond and the size of the cuts of a diamond, but growing up, I never used power equipment. I never worked on my own car. It wasn't until I started riding that, even when I got my first car, I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just going to bring it to the mechanic. It wasn't until I started riding a motorcycle that I started, and for the exact reason that you did it, or you mentioned, like, it's way too expensive to. I got my first bike when I was 17. I was making minimum wage. I couldn't afford to bring it to the mechanic. So I was like, I guess I have to learn how to do this. And every time something came off, it went on differently, you know, whether it was I was painting it or replacing it or doing some sort of work to it. It just ended up turning into like a lesson plan for me, as far as like, okay, well, if I have to replace this, I'm gonna look up YouTube videos and you know how that goes.
Yeah, I've always been super good, like my whole life, I guess, because my dad died so young, I've been like so into heirlooms. It's like his coin collection or like my grandfather's like wedding band or whatever it is. Like, I think heirlooms are just awesome things that I hope this generation decides to pass on to their children as well, because it's like such a tangible thing that you can carry around with you. It's got your whole family history, and then to get that motorcycle as an heirloom is pretty sick. I don't know how else to put it. It's fucking awesome.
No, I hear you.
Yeah, changed my whole life.
My grandmother died recently, and she used to wear this ring. It was a signet ring from her brother. And it says EW on it. It stands for Ellie Wolf, which is her last name. Mm. And I remember like a couple years ago, she's wearing it, and she's in the back of the car, and I'm driving. She's like, "I want to give this to you." And I started getting kind of emotional, and she's like, "But not until I die." And I was like, "Thanks, Grandma. I appreciate that." But yeah, she passed away, and I have it now, and she wore it on her middle finger because it was sized for a man, and I wear it on my pinky, so I've got like a pinky ring now. Never thought I'd be a dude rocking a pinky ring, but
well, it's one thing, grandmother. It's one thing to be a dude rocking a pinky ring who went and bought it. It's like I would make fun of your pinky ring that you went and bought, but if you got your hand-me-down like generational pinky ring, that's fucking sick.
Yeah, hell yeah. That's exactly
different
how
vibe
I feel.
For sure.
And it's definitely, well, it is a different vibe for sure, but it definitely takes a little while to get used to, especially when you're just not used to wearing a ring on that hand, never mind that finger. Like, I have a wedding band on, but that's on one finger, and then, you know, the pinky ring is on the other hand, and it's different, but it is really cool, and it's nice because, you know, now I have a kid, and she's going to get that one day when I croak, or, you know, for some reason before that, I don't know.
Yeah.
It is nice. It's nice to have stuff like that.
Yeah. I got my grandpa's pinky ring, come to think of it, but I can't stand rings.
No.
Phobic.
Yeah, I hear you, man. So you get back from Syria, you write your book, and you publish your book. Did you decide to go to Ukraine after taking that 2 years, or did you do it in that time, or when did that fall into the time frame?
I mean, the Ukraine thing kicked off, like the full scale invasion kicked off probably at my lowest point, where I was like, I had gotten real sick one winter, and so I started taking NyQuil. And the fucking NyQuil would give me the most insane combat dreams. And so I was having all those dreams. And after I quit being sick, I didn't want to stop having combat dreams. So I just kept pounding NyQuil every night, just so I could just like get teleported back. And I was like kind of in the middle of that weird spiral. And I guess I was addicted to NyQuil for a hot minute. But it was like during that Russia invaded. And then, like, because I was like in such a downward spiral, I was already in contact with a bunch of my old friends. And so I remember watching the invasion happen live. I was living in Virginia at the time, just like, holy shit, like 9 o'clock at night. And pretty much the next morning,
that was a wild night.
Yeah, that was insane. I went to bed, woke up, and the next morning I was like, I got to figure out how to get to Ukraine.
Wow. I saw one of your posts that said, did you link up with a guy that you were with in Syria over there too? Or was that a separate instance?
Yeah, I linked up with a few guys who I was with in Syria, actually. It was like just a stream of ex-YPG guys who were coming in, wound up in a Telegram group chat with a group called the Wolverines. And
that's so sick.
Yeah, I guess we were the Wolverines. That unit was whatever, but it did get me my foot into the country. It had a couple ex-YPG guys, a couple ex-Peshmerga guys. So it was like all the old Kurdistan volunteers saw their next opportunity to chase the dragon. Yeah, so it's like by the end of it, I think I had run into at least a dozen or more former YPG volunteers there.
I'm sure that if you're listening to this right now, you know how difficult it is to find factual, non-biased, and non-sensationalized information regarding the gun community and the things that actually matter to us. I can't tell you the amount of times I've gone to look something up, whether it be an event in the gun community, some bill that is proposed, or something new in the firearms industry, and I have to filter through somebody's politics, personal beliefs, and all that garbage that is getting in between myself and the information that I am looking for. It is truly exhausting sometimes. That is why we are excited to tell you about this episode's sponsor, The Reload. The Reload is where you can find non-sensationalized, fact-based reporting on issues relevant to gun owners. I subscribed after our episode with Stephen Gutowski, the founder of The Reload, and haven't looked back since. It's been an invaluable resource to me as somebody who wants to be plugged into this stuff but doesn't have time to go through 20 articles to sift through the bullshit. Whether you're serious about this stuff or just casually interested, as a gun owner, you want to make sure you have the right information. So go check out The Reload at the link in this episode's bio and save 25% on a membership just for listening to this podcast. All right, enjoy the rest of the show. Well, do you think that, I mean, because, you know, fighting for autonomy is kind of like, it's a tale as old as time, really. You know, you've got that going on in Syria still, but having fought for that over there, did you kind of see this as an easy transition to fighting in Ukraine?
Yeah. I mean, I was in pretty heavy combat in Syria. Was like getting pounded by mortars and like it was nothing compared to like the capabilities that Russia had. But I was like, I felt like I was still physically fit. Like I still had the mental acuity and like the know-how in a combat situation to be productive there. And then it's like at the end of the day, like an invading country is an invading country. You know, like it's really, really, really hard to justify invading anywhere. It's like, even though earlier I said like borders are kind of bullshit, it's like also bullshit to try and expand your borders by killing a bunch of people.
Well, right. Yeah. So that expansionism though is a function of the bullshit of having rigid borders in the first place. If it wasn't for these hard lines on a map, there wouldn't be such a desire to be like, I need to control just a little further. I need to take over this country, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like you want to expand your resources and get more territory to hold. But yeah, like going into a country and killing a bunch of people is the same no matter how you slice it. So in that situation, unless it's super justified for some reason, then I'm 99% of the time going to side with the country that's getting invaded. So I guess on that front, it was like an easy transition. But there again was like a little bit of a moral dilemma because like you go from fighting for someone in the middle of a revolution trying to get that liberation initially to fighting on the side of a nation state that had a lot of problems before the war. And I mean, like, I'm fully with Ukraine, but like, let's not sit here and pretend that they didn't have a lot of issues in their government before this war started.
Yeah, and I think that's one of those things that a lot of people, I think we are a very black and white society, and I think
everybody wants like a perfect victim, right?
Yeah.
Like it's like if we're gonna spend any resources or any time helping this country, they gotta be absolute Boy Scouts, every one of them.
Yeah, you know? Like we saw
it's just like that's not real life though. I mean that's not Eastern Europe.
Yeah, there's nuance to everything.
Exactly. You saw in the beginning when Putin tried to justify the invasion as denazifying Ukraine, and they would show a couple pictures of like actual Nazis in Ukraine and be like, see, this is the whole country. And meanwhile, you'd have people who had been fighting, you know, who had been staunchly anti-Nazi also fighting in Ukraine, and they'd totally forget about people like that. But like just as an example, not even like it revolved around that ideology at all. It was just that was the token thing that they were going to use to help justify.
Yeah, and I mean, even the
provoked.
Yeah, even this like idea that's floating around that the Azov Battalion is like full of just nothing but white supremacists is also like just not true. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and tell you there's not a bunch of white supremacists in the Azov Battalion, but like it's a lot of guys who are just like from that area near Mariupol who are in that unit to try and defend themselves against Russia. So it's like Ukraine had a lot of gray to it, whereas Syria was like super black and white, cut and dry. Like it's fucking ISIS, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
It's like that probably was the closest morally to a war since World War II and fighting against Nazi Germany. Ukraine was different in that respect, for sure.
Yeah, I can see that. And I definitely think, you know, it's like we were talking before. I think the fact that it's not, even though it's Eastern Europe, the fact that I think we can associate better with Ukrainians than we can with Syrians as like Western people, I think really helped as far as the American public latching onto that and then finding one way or another. Really what it is like, I think we find it easier to sympathize with white people at war than we do with like poor brown people or what we perceive as poor brown people. And it sucks because I think it can be the same struggle, but because these people live in an environment that we're not familiar with, we don't have as much sympathy for them than these people.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that's like upsetting, like, I don't know. Cause to me, like people are people, it's like I put my life on the line for two different looking people, but the American public has had such a different reaction to Ukrainians than they did with Kurdish people. Whenever Kurds and Yazidis were getting like actually full on genocided by ISIS. And it's like you see a lot of Middle Eastern people who are pissed off about how much people care about like what's going on in Ukraine. And yeah. I can totally see where they're coming from being pissed off about that because you've had this shit happening in your backyard for fucking 40 years and nobody bats an eye. And it's just like how life goes there.
I remember, from around the time of the big invasion, there was a, it was on CNN. Some reporter afield was talking to the anchor back in America, and he was like, it's just shocking to see this. You know, you would expect to see this in a country in the Middle East, but yes. Here, you know, these are buildings that look like my buildings. These are people that look like my people.
He said white people.
Yeah. And it's like, this is a guy that would probably not consider himself racist. You know, he's probably not like a white pride guy, but he's just got no idea that what he's saying is just batshit insane. Like,
yeah, it's like, there's a lot of people in this country who wouldn't consider themselves racist, but then like have these biases that have been ingrained in them, like into how their neighborhoods are laid out and whatever the contributing factors are to where, like, if they see a dead Ukrainian child, they're going to react differently to that picture of that dead Kurdish child that was washed up on the shores of the Mediterranean years ago. And
yeah.
It sucks.
Oh, yeah.
Cause like people are people everywhere. Like people have this tendency to say, oh, it's not our cause. Like, why should we care? Motherfucker, you should care because they're also human beings. It's like they don't want to be involved in a war any more than you would if someone invaded your neighborhood and blew up your bakery, you know? It's like people everywhere around the world.
Yeah. We see that now with Palestine. You know, you've got over, I think they just hit 30,000 people dead.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. And then you've got these people who will go to these, you know, democratic conventions and protest, and they get drowned out by a sea of NIMBY liberals saying vote for Biden or Biden number one, whatever. Biden number one. But it's crazy the cognitive dissonance that goes on. Like you know, we were talking earlier, like I look at it as a dad, as somebody who I can't imagine being in the position that some of these families are in. And
it's so hard. People are like, you know, oh, it's so complicated. There's so much history there. And I've got in my mind this like fresh image of like a grandfather cradling the corpse of his granddaughter, talking about how he had just left to go get her a chocolate or something.
Yeah, like that shit right there, that thing.
Like, oh, it's complicated, huh?
That is absolutely not complicated. And
no.
Fucking cognitive.
Like, I'm like, I bet you could give me a history lesson. I'm sure you could. I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
But I don't know what something that happened 40, 50 years ago has to do with this moment right here.
Yeah, and I mean, even the things that happened. So like a lot of people say, oh, well, 40 or 50 years ago, Israel got invaded by all the Arab countries. And it's like, well, yeah, a bunch of fucking people from Europe just rolled in and started killing a bunch of Palestinians. And yeah, it's like everyone has this line they want to draw.
It's complicated, though. It's complicated. There's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, but everyone's got this line they draw to how far back is relevant. It's like, well, how far do we extend this fucking argument that you've got here?
Yeah.
And usually it winds up in a place they don't want to talk about.
Yeah.
I had this.
They're like, this is also the ancestral homeland of the Jews. I'm like, okay, well, what about, what about the people that were there pre-religion? What about them?
Where's the line? Mesopotamic times.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I had that conversation with a family member of mine, and I put it in terms that they could understand by saying, what would you do if when you were a child, the government came in, your state government came in and said, this state or your town no longer belongs to you. It belongs to this foreign country. Not even people that are your neighbors, but people who just came in out of nowhere and you have to move. You'd be pissed, right? And I explained to him, like, how do you think people are born, like, into generational hatred of one another? Like, shit like that happens to somebody as a kid. And it's the same thing like what we did in the Middle East and in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're bombing the shit out of kids' parents. And then what do those kids want to do when they grow up? They want to kill us. Yeah. But, like, if you were in their shoes, would you feel any differently?
Yeah, then the look on most people's faces whenever you tell them that is like, oh, well, it's different. Like, oh, I don't know. I think you probably feel the exact same way.
Yeah, that's an easy way to say I don't want to think about it.
Yeah, exactly.
A terminal thought.
Yeah, I don't know. What's going on in Palestine is an entirely different level of fucked up from Ukraine, from some parts of Syria. Some parts of Syria, it's similar, but it's just like indiscriminate. It's indiscriminate. That's ridiculous. I don't know. It's a hard thing to think about. Like, whenever you actually sit down and think about whatever city you live in, every fucking thing getting flattened, and then you having to leave to go to another place that then also gets flattened. It's horrible.
Yeah, imagine living in a city and you gotta leave. And, you know, everything around you is blown up and flattened. The whole place is wrecked. And then somebody in another country tries to tell you, like, oh, they were just aiming at the terrorists. They weren't trying to kill you.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got out of there with like three hours to spare before the carpet bombing. But
even if that was true, there's intent and there's impact, you know, like,
right.
Yeah.
You weren't trying to kill your brother. Well, they fucking killed your brother.
Didn't try hard not to.
Like, exactly. If I was trying to beat a light and get through before it turned red and it was yellow and I T-boned a family in there in their minivan.
Didn't mean to. Oopsie.
I'm not going to be like, that wasn't my intent. Fuck you. You were in the wrong spot at the wrong time.
Yeah, you're going to get it downgraded from murder to manslaughter, but like...
You still killed them.
Up.
Yeah.
You fucked up pretty bad.
I like that you use the proper terminology there because I can't tell you the amount of times that my... like anal retentive. I hate being the like word police on social media. But when people will be like, especially after cop killings, they'll be like, that was murder. I'll be like, I'm like thinking in my head, actually it wasn't murder. It wasn't premeditated. Like, and it's not even worth saying.
Well, I do words for a living. So
yeah.
Yeah. I would hope you'd use the right words.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's,
I called, Obama and Biden war criminals for their drone campaign on Facebook, and somebody who actually ostensibly agrees with me on a lot of the foreign policy questions was like, you know, they're technically not war criminals because they weren't convicted in the, you know, in the Hague.
I hate that. But
I was like,
okay, I see what you're doing.
I don't care.
Playing my own game, damn it. In the court of public opinion, they're war criminals.
Yeah.
You ever heard of a figure of speech?
Nope. Nope. You can say murder is a figure of speech then.
Speaking of writing. All right. Okay. So.
Talking about writing
books. What's that?
Writing with a T.
Writing with a T. That's right.
All
right.
Writing.
All right. You get back from Syria. You write some books. You write a novella. You write A Good Place on the Banks of the Euphrates. It looks like, I have not read all of your stuff, but it looks like you've got a good mix of like pure fiction, nonfiction, essays, and just like personal stuff. Is it normal to, and now you've got those new zines kind of spawned by your experience in the Ukraine, with the, you know, that mixes the photography with some of your unpublished stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So is this sort of like a normal career path to kind of like move back and forth between these genres? These like writing worlds?
I would say like moving back and forth between genres is definitely a normal career path for a writer. It's like looking at my bookshelf, like Joan Didion, Anthony Doerr, Ernest Hemingway, Toni Morrison. Like those are some big name authors. They wrote fiction and they wrote nonfiction. For me, a lot of my fiction is so informed by my actual life. And then I maybe change like my fiction, I change a major detail. And then my nonfiction, I change minor details to make the story work a little better.
Sure.
So like for me, it's usually a blurred line between what's fiction and what's nonfiction.
Yeah.
But in terms of like my career path as a writer, I've kind of gone against the grain in a lot of ways. Like as you mentioned, the zine that I do with Liam Kennedy, it's called Locating Troubles. Issue 2 is on pre-order right now. That is something that we just kind of came up with one day because we figured, you know, like I'm writing all these stories, he's taking all these pictures, and like what sucks about publishing nowadays is most of the shit that you see that is of any quality, like anything that is like good, they're probably not getting paid for it. Like outside of the New Yorker or the Paris Review and maybe like 5 or 6 other like literary magazines, nobody pays a dime. Like I had published, I think close to 30 stories and had made $145. And it finally got to the point where I was like, I know people want to read this and I'm not getting paid anything for it. And it's like, it's stopping me from wanting to publish it because I'm putting in all this work for nothing. And it's stopping them from being able to read it because I don't want to publish it for free. And this is like a good middle ground where it's like, hey, here's some stuff I've been working on and people seem to enjoy what I'm doing regardless. So this zine that we're doing is like a way for both of us to use the things that we've made creatively kind of on our own and get it out into the world.
That's awesome, man. Why do you think, I mean, I feel like I know, but why do you think it is that people are publishing things and not getting paid for it? Is it kind of like, is this a way of the papers or material that they end up publishing in to kind of say like, well, you being published with us is enough because it's getting your name out there? Is that kind of like what they're doing?
It's like you're getting paid in exposure.
Son of a bitch. That's an unpaid internship kind of thing. Bullshit. Yeah. Like you're getting the experience and people are getting to know you kind of thing.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, I published in this one magazine that took on probably the best story I ever wrote. And they responded to me within 3 hours. They were like, oh, this piece is amazing. We want it. I was like, great. They paid me $16, which was at the time, more than I had been paid for the majority of my pieces. And they sent me a free copy, which was one more copy than most of the other magazines had given me.
Wow.
And then that piece that was in that magazine went on to win some awards. And it was like, yeah, I got some good exposure, but like what really came from it? And a lot of these publications are barely staying afloat. And then think about publishing now versus 20 years ago versus 80 to 100 years ago. There's so much less money in it now. People, like, think about all your friends. Like, who reads? And it's probably...
I don't.
Yeah, there's probably a handful of your friends.
I do.
But then you think about all of your friends. It's like, who thinks I should read more? You know?
And yeah, most people,
Yeah, like, oh, I wish I could read more. And so most of the stuff that I write, it's like my tagline is fine literature for the working class. It's like, I hate reading something that just tries to show you how smart the author is. It's like, I would much rather see you create something through words that is universal, that everybody can understand from the highbrow to the lowbrow, men, women, like everyone can get it. And recently there's been this kind of turn in both like college MFA programs and big publishers, like they turning toward this highbrow. So like Crazy Rich Asians is like the first book that comes to mind because rich is in the title. It's like these books are about rich people for rich people. I mean, even like Colson Whitehead is an author and he won 2 Pulitzer Prizes. And I read one of his books, The Underground Railroad, and then I read another one. I was like, damn, this guy's won 2 Pulitzer Prizes. I wonder what his background is. And his parents are like donors to the fucking Guggenheim Foundation. It's like, oh, you came from this much money. No wonder you're doing so well with getting your work out there.
Yeah.
And it's like the same, it's nepotism, like to the extreme. The same reason why Tom Hanks' son is now an actor.
Tom Hanks' son is fucking nuts. Like, yeah. I don't know whether to like him or hate him.
Wait, I only know his work in movies. I don't know anything about the guy, like, in as a person. Why is he nuts?
I've seen a couple interviews. I know. Sorry, we're getting off track now, but I've seen a couple interviews of him with him, and he is so out there. I'm thinking of the right guy, right?
Well, I don't know. You tell me.
I don't know what he's like personally, but if he grew up with Tom Hanks' money, yeah, he's probably fucking cooker.
Yeah, fair. Okay, I'm confident that I'm talking about the right guy.
Like
all no explanation.
Fucking psychopath.
Fucking
Miley Cyrus versus Billy Ray Cyrus.
Yes.
I'd take Miley Cyrus over Billy Ray.
Yeah,
I don't know enough about Billy Ray Cyrus to accurately answer that.
I feel like I'm just being controversial. I don't know enough about either of them to actually make it.
Would you rather see Billy Ray Cyrus naked on a wrecking ball? Probably not. Oh, no. I'm not judging.
Well. No.
Anyway. Warren,
we're talking about making literature that's direct,
that's accessible.
Accessible.
I love that.
That is
one of my biggest faults with reading is that I will pick up a book based on what I want to get out of it. And then I'll get into like half a chapter deep and I'll just be like, this is totally uninteresting. Like I used to try to read self-help books. Like, God, there's nothing more obnoxious than that, dude. Funny like
that.
And like, so a better example, I really wanted to read Christopher Hitchens' last book. But he is so fucking smart. And not that I'm not smart, but I don't want to read. I don't want to be like, I don't want to work to read a book.
He's got a flowery style of writing.
Yes. I don't want to work to read a book. And
there's a famous Ernest Hemingway like anecdote that's in the back of one of these books that's about just Hemingway's writing career. And it's this woman says that she pulled into a gas station at 12 a.m. And it was right after The Old Man and the Sea came out in, I think it was Life magazine. And the cashier at the cash register has this line built up. And this trucker is like complaining to her. He's like, hey, can we hurry up this line? And she says, shut up and listen to this. And just starts reading The Old Man and the Sea. And it goes on for like 10 or 15 minutes. And like all these truckers at midnight at the truck stop are just like hooked. And that's the cool thing to me about literature is whenever you can speak to both the upper end and the lower end in that manner.
That's awesome. And, you know, not knocking Christopher Hitchens by any means. It could just be me. But that is really cool when you can write something so that anybody can pick it up and read it and get something out of it.
Yeah, I mean, there's books that I pick up and I'll start reading them and I'll have this, like, I'm in a fucking master's program. Like, I'm a smart guy and I know that. But, like, I'll pick up a book and go, damn, it takes me too much brain power to give a fuck about reading the rest of this book. Like, I'll just put it down.
Yeah, like it feels like exercise. I don't want that if I'm reading a book for pleasure.
It's like the advice I'll give anybody is like, if you're reading a book and not if you get bored, because like you got to kind of train yourself to read and to get through it whenever it's in its low spots and stuff. But if you're reading a book and you're like, damn, this sucks, or this is like totally uninteresting and I don't know if anything interesting is going to happen, then put the motherfucker down. Like you're just going to make yourself hate reading.
Yeah. I think that's what I've kind of done to myself over. So Andrew's recently got me back into audiobooks, and I'm hoping that's going to jumpstart my interest in reading actual books again.
Yeah, hope so.
Yeah, we'll see. I really like the one that he's got me.
We talked him into listening to Footfall by Niven and Purnell.
I haven't read it.
I love sci-fi, and it's like right up my alley. It's aliens and spaceships, but it's like back in the 80s, I think.
It's very dated. It's very 80s.
But it's good.
You think about Kurt Vonnegut. Kurt Vonnegut's a nice sci-fi, and then
Kurt Vonnegut's easy to read, not in a derogative way. Like it's just it's got like energy. It's got like a flow. It's got momentum to it, you know.
And he's funny.
Like you start and they're not that long. You know, but you start a Kurt Vonnegut book and it's just like, you just want to finish it.
Well, that's the only thing about this audiobook that it's 25 hours long of
Footfall is very long.
But I'm getting into it. I get it in like 20 minutes at a time. I get it in slivers.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It'll happen eventually. Dude. Sorry, I'm super conscious now of the tone that my voice is in because the guy, one of our friends listened to this previous episode and he said that because we had him do it. Well, we didn't have him do it. He did an intro for us in the tone of like Mr. TV movie guy.
Yeah. Trailer voice.
Yeah.
He put music in the background and everything. It's pretty funny, but he's like, why'd you lower your voice to match mine for the rest of the episode? And I was like, I didn't do that, but now I'm wondering if I did.
Maybe you're just finding your voice.
Maybe. You know what it is? I listen to my own voice come through these headphones, and it sounds like I'm in an ASMR video, so I think I want it to sound as velvetly smooth as possible.
Do you ever just get really excited, and then you get hyper-aware of how excited you sound, so you're like, be cool.
Yes, that's my life. That's my life. Whenever I get
serious.
That's how you know if you're around true friends, because you can show that kind of excitement and not feel that withdrawn effect right after.
Yeah. My favorite thing is like talking to somebody you don't know, and you sort of get to know them a little bit, and then you figure out what they're into, and then they just start going on and on. I don't give a fuck what it is. If you're pumped about it, I'll sit there and listen to you.
Fuck yeah. 100%. I love listening to people who are enthusiastic about something.
Yeah.
I'll end up like watching videos on trains on YouTube for like hours, or trains, boats, I don't know, trucks. Things that are this is my YouTube queue now at this point, because of the people who are talking about them are so pumped, are so jazzed that like this is their thing. Yeah, it's a win for sure when you find someone like that.
Yeah.
I'll never forget this last Woodland Brutality. It's a two-gun match in Virginia. A couple of the guys that I was staying with were from like the InRange TV team, and one of them starts, I forget what he was talking about, but before he started talking about it, he goes, wait, is this something that you're actually interested in? And I was like, what?
Oh,
and he's
yeah.
like, before I deep dive into this,
was
I want to make
sure
you're actually... No.
Oh.
It was, but it makes sense. He's like, before I deep dive into this, I just want to make sure you're actually interested in it. My wife tells me I should ask that more often. And I was like, yeah, I'm interested. And then he just went for it. And I was like, I definitely see why he asked now, but this is awesome.
Yeah, because you know it's like you can get kind of used to this this like feeling of rejection where you're like so excited and dumping this info on someone, you know, and then like partway through they're like
they weren't ready.
I don't give a shit. I don't want to do this today. And you're like, oh, that's okay. That's just my heart and soul, whatever.
I didn't want to do it anyway. I just yeah. I didn't really want to, you know. I was just I'm glad you told me to stop because I wanted to stop anyway.
So it's good to ask first, I think.
Yeah. Warren, kind of a random jump here, but I forgot to ask you. I'm no professional, so occasionally I do forget things and I ask things out of order. But we let our Patreon supporters ask some questions. We'll let them know who we're talking to beforehand, and if they have questions, they can write in. We try to ask them, and I wanted to ask you this also because one of the pictures that I shared on our Patreon was you standing with two of your friends, and you're all holding puppies, and they want to know where you got the puppies. What's the story behind that picture?
Oh, fucking those puppies. I know exactly what picture you're talking about. All right. So we were at
picked that one for a reason because I love dogs. And I was like, this guy's clearly my people.
So we were at our it's like our base in Syria. And we went out for morning PT. I think we did like a 4 or 5 mile run. And we left and we ran down the road and like kind of left our long driveway. Ran around some hills or whatever and then came back and then we got to the end of the driveway and when we left there was no fucking box of puppies. Whenever we got back there was a box of fucking puppies that someone had left there.
God.
Because all the Goondies around us knew that all those Europeans and Americans, those internationals fucking love puppies. And they didn't have the heart to kill them and they were like, oh, we'll give them to the foreigners. It's like, they'll take care of the dogs. And so that's what we fucking did.
They'll take from their own food that they their hard won food and water, and they'll give it to the dogs.
Yeah, we'll feed the shit out of them. So we got attacked with some fucking puppies, and then we took care of them. That's exactly what happened. They got what they wanted. We raised all of them up, and that picture was like the day that we first got the puppies, and we were just stoked to have puppies around. It was the most exciting thing that happened in weeks.
That's awesome. I know the abundance of joy that I feel when I see on a day-to-day basis a dog walking into the room or if I'm like going to a place and there's a dog there. So I can't imagine being in a literal fucking war zone where there's just shit, like shitty stuff happening all around you and then having puppies show up out of nowhere.
Yeah, it was sick. I mean, it's like all of the locals kind of were ambivalent about dogs, like dogs would sleep outside and kind of eat the leftovers, but we like are all from Europe and America for the most part. And like obviously grew up with dogs and we always took good care of them. So they would just give us the puppies cause they didn't want to deal with feeding them anyway.
Yeah.
But there are also a shitload of like stray dogs, like packs of wild dogs that would roam around all the time. We wound up having to shoot a few. There was fucking bad time. They would come and like try to attack our dogs to get the scraps that we were given to them. Dog culture in Syria is a different game.
Yeah, dog culture. It's toxic. You could say
feral and wild dogs are like a whole. They're like a whole thing. You know.
Yeah.
And they don't have things like coyotes that interbreed with feral dogs, but you'll still get. They call them like pariah dogs. You'll still get like, you know, dogs that have a lineage of domesticated dog in them, but they have not grown up domesticated and they're very unlikely to become domesticated.
Yeah, exactly.
So what, they just look like golden retrievers, but they're feral as fuck?
No, they could, if that was what they're descended from, but fair. You know, there's other breeds over there.
I know. Yeah, that was from one of our friends.
Yep. Imagine your kids just being hunted in the streets by a golden retriever.
Well, don't make jokes. That actually does happen here in America.
There's somebody up.
Yeah. Dude, there was a lady a couple years back who got mauled by a pack of dachshunds.
Fuck.
Okay, but they're like fucked up, though. Dachshunds, they're when they're doing their actual job that they were bred for.
Yeah, I know, killing rodents and shit. But can you imagine? Like, I would be like, don't put that on my obituary. Just say that I died of natural causes. Just say,
what did she fall on the ground? She couldn't get up.
I probably they probably didn't scale her like little mini spider dogs.
Well, I don't know. I probably shouldn't laugh about this. This is someone's grandmother.
That's okay. If I die like that, I give you permission to laugh about it. That sucks. Because you can literally grab one of those things and swing them. Like, that's... All right, we don't need to talk about that. We don't need to go into detail about fighting on a bag of Datsuns.
Would you rather fight one ISIS terrorist or 100 Dachshunds?
Who, me?
You don't have to answer anyway, that.
No,
you don't have to answer that.
That was not a real question for anyone.
Am I armed?
Yes, you have two of them.
Yeah, you got two arms.
No arms, no weapons. All right. Ah, shit. I guess I'm going Dachshunds.
Yeah, I agree.
Man. Tim also asked, what was your favorite weapons that you used over season Y? I know it's kind of like, I read that and I was like, bro, it's not called.
Then, no, this is a gun guy question, right?
But it is a gun guy question. Yeah, I'm sure.
This is a gun podcast, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
We do sometimes talk about gun stuff. Yeah, allegedly. Yeah. Exactly. We sometimes talk about gun stuff, but I'm
always
curious.
We're here for the culture more than the guns, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm always curious how that works. Like, because, you know, I'll admit that, you know, I had no idea the YPG was so organized. So I wonder if it's like Western militaries where you're issued a rifle, everybody gets the same thing.
Do you get to have like a favorite gun, or is it just like whatever you're working on that day?
You essentially get issued a rifle, but it's not like you check it out. It's like they hand you the rifle, then that is your rifle until you swap it for something else. But it like does happen through an armory, and there is. That's OPSEC. But yeah, it does like come through.
Yeah. You don't need to like tell us like state secrets or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, you'll get handed a rifle, and it can be any number of things. I mean, in Syria, I had a Russian AKM, had a PKM, had a Dragunov, and had a M16A2.
At the same time?
At various times.
Okay.
Had the M16 and Dragunov at the same time. And a PKM. I guess, yeah, I had a lot of fucking guns. Anyway, my favorite was, and then in Ukraine, I had PKM and I had an AK-74 and I had a Dragunov. I think my favorite in terms of assault rifle, like the A2 was cool and I enjoyed it, but I definitely prefer the AK platform. Just because it's just more intuitive to me, and it's like an AK is like an old Harley, and an M16 is like a modern sports car in my brain.
Yeah.
But of all the weapons I've used, the Dragunov is by far the finest rifle I have ever touched, whether overseas, back home. I would, if I had to pick only one, it'd be a Dragunov.
Why is that? Just made how they're made, or just
how they're
made,
able
to do with
how
it?
They operate. Like, it's like a scaled up AK, essentially disassembling it, zeroing the scope on a Dragunov. Like, I got to the point where I could zero somebody else's. Like, we had this Arab kid, he was like 18 probably, who had a Dragunov, and he's like, I don't know how to zero it. And I was like, give me your fucking rifle. And in less than 60 seconds had it zeroed. It's like, you know how an AK is just super dumbed down, simple? The Dragunov is like that, but like the nicest fucking rifle you've ever held. They're just so well made.
That's awesome.
Yeah, they're a real vibe. They got a whole look to them.
He said they're a real vibe. They have a whole look to them.
They do have a whole look to them. They do.
Absolutely. Yeah. As you're saying that, I had this like daydream where I'm just like, man, it is a real trip talking to someone who has shot these guns before in situations that like people make video games about.
Yeah.
And my only experience with these is in literal video games. Just like the duality of man here, right? Or something.
Yeah. I mean, PKM is a fucking blast as well, but it always has problems. At least all the shitty ones that I ever picked up.
That's just machine gun vibes, though. That's just like the, like, I've never heard anybody say about a light machine gun or even a general purpose machine gun, like, yeah, it was super reliable all the time.
Dude, yeah. I don't know. I think that's kind of the case with open bolt weapons in general. Like, we had, like, I had the saw for 4 years and loved it. Like, it was incredibly reliable, but there was always, we were always told, you know, if you're doing room clearing, the saw guy doesn't go first because it could jam at any time. And if it jams and you've got a big paperweight, that never, you know.
The thing I hated about
how sick would that be? Clearing a room with a saw, just the.
People have done it though. Like, that's not to say, like, they tell you what you shouldn't do, and then what people do are two completely different things. There's nothing in the e-tool manual that says that you can kill somebody with it, but there's a confirmed kill by a corporal in Iraq, I think it was. Yeah. That killed.
I want to be clear that I don't actually think there's anything sick about room clearing. That was an edgy joke. I don't want anyone to think I'm out here.
Hey, like, well, listen, you're talking to a guy who went and basically fought two wars for fun. Unpaid. So, like, yeah, clearing rooms is kind of sick. It's way more sick when nobody's in them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
right. That was, who said that? It's like, you don't, oh, fuck, I'm going to butcher it now. It's like, room clearing isn't something that you want to ever be doing. And if you ever have to do it, you just want to, like, you're just lucky to get out. You're not going to win. You're just lucky to live.
Yeah.
It's like any landing you walk away from is a good one.
Any what?
Any landing. It's something pilots say. Any landing you can walk away from is a good one.
Yeah.
Nice. I'm going to start saying that to the passengers on the flight that I next flight.
No, it's fine.
Any landing you all can walk away from is a good one. Yeah, we'll see. I'll have to up my game because right now I just airdrop memes to people.
What, on airplanes?
Yeah, like whenever there's turbulence, I'll airdrop like an appropriate meme. Like, not anything
vulgar. What's an appropriate meme for turbulence?
It'll be like, I don't know, like Chris Rock going like, or something, you know, what's the term? Like, damn, you know, whenever, like, this term, it's, I don't know, it's appropriate to me. It makes sense in that context, but they rarely get accepted. So I don't think anybody else thinks they're funny. It's one of those things, like, I've gotten way too used to laughing at my own jokes in public. So at this point, I just make jokes for myself, and then people that laugh, it's extra.
I would laugh at your jokes.
That's exactly. But that's, man, that's the show, Warren. That's, what'd you think?
It was nice. I enjoyed it. I had a good time. glad we got to come on here and chit chat a little bit.
Man.
Yeah, I'm glad, dude.
It was a good time. We talked about some good things, some bad things, and I'm really glad that we got to get you on here because, you are a cool fucking dude and, it's just still so surreal to me that we get to talk to people like you, to be honest, man. Even doing this, like, this is going to be our 51st episode, and every episode, you know, our point is to connect our listeners with people that we think are cool and people that give something to the community or have just done like super cool stuff. And I feel like you fit both of those things, not to mention you also ride motorcycles, and I'm pretty sure I follow you on my personal page. I'm just saying it's cool. Like, I just like connecting with people that are cool and have done cool shit. And I'm going to get a punch card for the amount of times that I can say cool here. But,
I'm pretty sure
cool people don't talk like that, Jordan.
I never said I was cool. It's refreshing to see, like, someone who's not, I don't know, hard right, like, give a shit about guns. Like, Most of the pages I know wouldn't have the same opinions on Palestine. It's like there's this weird tendency on the left for, I guess, the whole left, except for the really far ones, to be like, oh, guns are bad. I was like, well,
yeah.
Until you need them, then what?
Yeah.
we feel that, dude. That is a story of our lives. Really?
We definitely occupy a weird space politically and ideologically.
Oh, yeah. Our corner of the internet is the weirdest.
Yeah, and
but it's cool.
Yeah,
as fuck.
And it brings out the weirdos for sure. And I love most of them.
I've never seen so many pictures of cat ears in my DMs before in my life. I'm pro cat ears. Don't get me wrong. Like, I, we saw them on the site, and I have a pair on my ear pro, but. It is truly a unique corner of the internet that we are happy to occupy.
Yeah.
And we're happy to have you part of it, however you fit in, man.
Yeah. I'm trying to hold it down. If you don't mind me doing a little shameless promotion here.
Do it. Please do it. We're going to ask you, but we're happy it came up organically.
Well, like I said, nobody ever really gets paid for any of their writing. But if you go to warrenstoddard.com, I got some links to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, local bookstores where you can get my books. Or you can directly order Locating Troubles, either one or two. There's war stories in there, love stories, motorcycle stories, some pictures. Those are on pre-order right now for this year, and then we close it up. So, yeah, that's pretty much my shameless self-promotion. I'm getting my master's degree other than that.
What's your master's in?
Creative writing.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
I don't know why I expected something like off the wall.
Finance, totally actually?
In line.
It's hopefully going to be more useful than my English bachelor's degree. But, time will tell.
Yeah, man, that's awesome. It's definitely going to be more useless than my no degree, but
nah.
That's also up for debate. That's another story altogether. I probably couldn't have done anything with my life without the military being one of my qualifications to getting a job, but that's we'll talk about
that. Hey, at least you used it for something.
Yeah, I did use it for something. That is a win. Also, before you go, we have a tradition on our show. We have to ask all of our guests. It's literally an obligation. If I cannot physically stand up from my chair until I do it. If you had,
it's actually a real curse.
I'm glued to my chair with magic, right in the gooch area. It's painful. I was going to try to let that one ride with just an awkward silence, and I just don't have the stomach for it. I'm so sorry. If you could leave us and the listeners with one piece of advice, it could be related to anything, but just something that you think would benefit people, what would that piece of advice be?
Now you got to take it with a grain of salt. But this is something I learned on the way to Syria, is that there really ain't no rules to this thing. You can kind of live life however you want it. You can do pretty much anything, as long as you don't do the wrong thing and try to, fuck with people. If you're normally good, and you have good intentions about things, you can you pretty much do whatever you want, as long as you're willing to live with whatever consequences come your way, because my life, like going to Ukraine, going to Syria, are not a normal life path, and they're not things that I guess people would think overtly you're allowed to do, but sometimes you step beyond that line and kind of push yourself a little bit, figure out where the boundaries lay, and life turns out pretty cool. Sometimes you wind up dead, but those are the consequences I was talking about.
That's part of the journey.
Wow.
That's it. Awesome, man. I love that. I'm going to leave with that. Well, thank you, Warren, for coming on, man. This was awesome.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We are super pumped to get this episode out. I think people are going to love it.
Yeah, another instant classic.
Only another banger, as the kids say.
Another banger. Racking them up.
That's it.
Thank you.